Welcome to Unrooted. I'm your host, Julie Hotz. If this is your first time to listen to Unrooted, I suggest you start with episode one, since season one is serialized. But if you're only here for the homesick episode, just dive right in, because each episode is made to be able to stand alone. Before we get started, I wanted to mention that you're going to hear a lot about Portland in this episode. Portland is on Chinook, Cowlitz, and Clackamas lands. And if you'd like to know more about the tribes and ancestral lands throughout Oregon, go to www.native-land.ca for more information, or find the Native Land app in the App Store. Now, on to the show. The movies always make it seem like moving to New York City is a dream come true. And it is for a lot of people, but not for everyone. When I began dating Miguel, I don't even remember how it came up, but he mentioned that even though he liked visiting New York City, he never planned on living there. This was great news to me. I also loved visiting, but living there sounded like a whole other beast. Plus, I loved my West Coast dearly. This admission of his, plus his budding love for Los Angeles, made me feel really safe. Like, even though his fellowship would end soon and he'd be looking for a new job, at least it wasn't likely that he'd move to New York City. Not even a year later, I was headed over the Verrazano Bridge, which connects Staten Island to Long Island, towards my new home in Brooklyn, New York. I paid upwards of $30 to go over that bridge because I had three axles, thanks to the trailer I was towing. Over $30 for a toll? That is ridiculous. Welcome to New York City.
Oh my God, I cannot wait until all the things are in the apartment and this trailer is returned.
Miguel and I had devised a plan for unloading my car and trailer, because parking in New York City is notoriously tricky. On the street I was about to live on, well, on the opposite side of the street, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 7 p.m., parking is not allowed at all because of rush hour traffic. So I decided that a little bit before 7 p.m., right before parking was opened back up, I would pull up and I would wait in my car until the clock struck 7 p.m. so I could secure that perfect parking spot right across the street from my building.
What? It's not even 7 and people are already staking out. This is ridiculous.
Apparently, everyone else with cars in Brooklyn had the same idea.
Hi.
But they knew better. They knew to get there really early.
Hi! Everyone's already taking the parking spaces, so I need to whip a U-turn. Do you think I should park directly across the street or by the crosswalk?
I can't fit in there, no.
What? No.
Here.
Well, what? Oh my gosh.
Can you tell how tired I was of towing a trailer? After parking, all we'd have to do is walk across the street with each and every box, go up 6 stories in an elevator that kind of smelled like pee, walk down 2 hallways, and put everything in my new home. And there I was. Home sweet home. Home, mostly empty apartment with no furniture home. The next day, when Miguel went to work, I stood in the living room looking at the stacks of boxes and listened to the sounds of the BQ train, which ran, uncovered, right behind our apartment building. I could see it out the window. I set up an appointment for internet installation, and when the Optimum employee arrived, he apologized for being late. In his GPS, he had accidentally chosen the street address with Parkway, but I live on an avenue. And it had taken him to another part of town before he realized his mistake. He apologized again and explained that he was new to town and still getting used to driving in the city. I wasn't mad at all. I'd found a friend. I was too shy to ask if I could bring out my recorder. But what I found out was that he had recently moved from Trinidad because his wife lived here and she wanted to stay in New York City, not go back to Trinidad. I told him I'd just moved from LA for my love. We talked about the sunshine and the laid-back vibes that we already missed in our respective past homes. I didn't have to ask if he was homesick. I could hear it in his voice and see it in his face. He'd left his business in the warm air behind and was now sitting in hours of traffic, listening to honking all day, trudging through cold rain and snow, and installing internet in impatient customers' homes. I really hoped that he'd feel at home soon. On Valentine's Day, I went to the basement to do laundry. While the clothes in the washer spun around in sudsy water, I cried, and I tried not to let the lady sitting next to me see. I couldn't help but ask myself, did I make the right decision? That night, Miguel and I ate our homemade Valentine's dinner on boxes and plastic tubs in the living room, while a lamp on the ground illuminated our faces. I think I'd made the right decision, but this was going to be hard. I was already in a depressive slump. Finances in my life were not great. The skies were so gray, and it got dark so early. I loved the cold, and I wished for snowstorms that would blanket the city in magic. But the gray and the dark sucked my energy away, and I understood how real seasonal affective disorder can be. On top of it all, there was something else. I was really homesick. I could feel it throughout my entire being. I was grieving, experiencing a full body grief, a heartache that radiated out, which consequentially made me feel like an ungrateful brat. I would tell myself, "Do you know how many people would love to have the chance to live in New York City? There's so much to do, so many opportunities to try and take advantage of. You are so privileged. Get over it." And I'm not proud of this, that I said these things to myself. But it's hard not to be mean to yourself sometimes, especially when you're feeling really bad. What is homesickness? Is it missing people? Or a place? Is it nostalgia? Are we missing a feeling we once had, longing to go back to a place or a person that once was? Have you ever been surfing? I'm a terrible surfer, but I enjoy being out in the water. In case you've never surfed, when you're trying to catch a wave and you get clobbered, the wave can be so forceful that it pushes you down into the ocean. And it can hold you down, keep you underwater until the wave has fully passed over. Sometimes, if you fall in the right way, it spins you around like you're a t-shirt in a front-load washer. I learned to surf at fairly rocky beaches, so I learned to always put my hands out in front of my head, because in the turmoil, I didn't always know where the wave was going to send me. If I would come too close to the rocks, and I'd much rather break or scrape my arms than my face. In fact, some of the beaches I'd go to even had old-timers who would wear helmets while surfing. Anyway, the best analogy for how I felt in those first weeks, months of homesickness, is to relate it to being held under by a wave. I felt like I was spinning into the unknown. I felt the weight of an entire ocean of grief holding my whole body down. I had my hands out to try and not crash too hard. And I was waiting, just waiting for that wave to pass so that I could rise surface and gasp for a fresh breath of air. I knew this whole body ache wouldn't last forever, but I didn't see the end of it either. Recently, I was visiting my family in Dallas because it was my nephew's first birthday. I took the opportunity to corner my sister Shelley, someone who's lived in Texas her whole life, to ask her about homesickness.
Tell me your name.
Shelley Blacketer.
Shelley is my sister, who is third born.
So, not to be confused with the sister you heard in episode one, which was Jenna.
Have you ever had a point in your life where you have felt homesick?
Yeah, oh, definitely. First things that come to mind are I have this very, very vivid recollection of being homesick when I went to go spend the night at my best friend Leah's house when we were really little. And just like the homesickness of all of a sudden it's just unfamiliar, or not even unfamiliar. Like I'd been at her house, I knew her parents, I knew her, but it's just, it's not the same. And there's just something about it. And I just got so homesick. I had to call my mom. She had to pick me up. And I remember, like, I was just so, like, almost relieved to be home. And I, like, can't even tell you why, because I loved spending the night with that friend. And we'd done it many, many times.
I definitely had my homesick moments throughout my childhood, too. In fact, when I hear the word homesick, my first thought is a kid that is missing their home or their parents, even if for a few hours or a couple days. Maybe because I first became familiar with that word as a kid in the midst of experiencing it myself.
And then, of course, as I've gotten older, there's been homesick moments. It usually happens when I first move somewhere. Like when I first moved to College Station for college, there's just kind of that loneliness and that I don't know what to do with myself. That even though I'm in my own space, I'm just kind of like a stranger in the space. With experience, as I've gotten older, I know just give it time and it goes away, and it does. It's luckily now I don't have to like call mom to come pick me up anytime I feel homesick, but I definitely have felt it again.
What do you think the last time, or when was the last time you felt homesick?
I don't know. I mean, I don't get homesick in the same way anymore, I don't think. Because now, usually like when I'm going places, I'm either with Kai or Casey or one of them.
Kai is Shelley's son, and Casey is Shelley's husband.
One of them, and I think when I have someone with me that's part of my home, I don't get homesick as easily. So I'm trying to think. I went on a trip recently just to go visit one of my friends in Alabama, and there's a little bit of homesick just like not being home with Casey, but not in the same way, because what actually helped is the fact that I brought Kai with me. I had several moments when I was like snuggled with him in bed, and I just thought this would be, I think, a little bit more lonely if like he weren't here, but the fact that he's here beside me, I'm not feeling that just that need to be home because I had brought a little part of it with me. So the last time I truly, truly felt it would have had to be probably sometime that I last just traveled by myself. There's always just a little hint of it, just wanting to go back to like the people that are in my home.
Here's the thing. Shelley's life is pretty rooted. She and her husband both have great jobs. They've got a house and two dogs. Homesickness is homesickness, whether it's acute or short-lived, a dull ache and long-term, or whether it has no end in sight, all of it hurts. But I'm really curious about long-term homesickness.
How do you think you would feel if you didn't know if you'd ever be able to go home again?
all my coping mechanisms will have failed me. Because I think that's what like gets me through. Like as an adult, I'm like, I can logically think, oh, it's okay because I will be going home soon. So I need to be enjoying the moment where I'm at. And so I can logically kind of almost like rationalize that homesickness away. So if I didn't have that ability, there would definitely be like, I think some mourning involved. Like it would be a true loss if I was told that I couldn't go back to my home or... But then I think, well, does that mean I can't go back to, like, the people? Or does that just mean I can't go back to just the place? if it were the people, that would be absolute, like, devastating. If it was just the place, like, if I was told, let's say I went on a vacation, and I was told, oh, your home was destroyed by a tornado while you were gone, I think I would mostly just be like, well, is Casey okay? Is Kai okay? And are the dogs okay? And if all of them were okay, I think, it'd be sad, but I don't know. It definitely wouldn't be the same as if I had lost, like, the person, obviously. I think that's what makes homesickness the strongest.
I know that I have felt homesick since I left LA for, like, the West Coast. And it feels weird. I know I have homes in lots of places with people that I love. But, yeah, I am past the mourning stage, but I still feel like, oh, it's good. But that doesn't mean that I'm not homesick, too.
Yeah. Well, there's even little things like Casey and I lived on the other side of Dallas over by White Rock Lake when we first got married, and we loved that area. But when we went to actually go buy a home, we just couldn't necessarily afford a home for the space over there. And so we even still talk about, like, oh, we miss living over there, like, it's by, you know, the lake or by this trail or by wherever. It's not necessarily like the feeling of homesick where it's like that deep, pitting, like, longing, but there is definitely, even just moving across town, you feel like you're missing out on certain things that you once were available. Even if I didn't necessarily take advantage of them at that time, it's the fact that I can't take advantage of it if I wanted to now. And you just feel like, oh man, there's just so many missed opportunities. And I think that's the thing. But it's not the same as like a deep, like, seriously, when I think about that time at Leah's, like, being homesick, like, it was just to your core. Like, I can recall the exact feeling and just this need to, like, almost just get out of there. It's almost like a claustrophobia, but not.
I mean, I also do wonder sometimes, you know, how much we build things up in our heads. Like, how much is it that I'm homesick and how much is it that I'm, like, oh, like, romanticizing the mountains or like romanticizing hanging out with my friends. But would I even be hanging out with them, or would I be like being my introverted self and at home watching a YouTube video?
Yes. That's, I think, like, oh man, I could have, like, you know, walked to the store here and done this. And I'm like, I lived there for like so many years and I didn't do any of that. Why do I think that I'd be doing that now?
FOMO is real.
FOMO is real.
Just in case you're not sure what FOMO means, it's an acronym for fear of missing out.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like for me, the first wave of homesickness I felt was I feel like it was kind of like heartbreak, kind of like a breaking up with someone that you're really sad to break up with, and you just feel kind of devastated.
Yeah, and now I'm kind of getting like that question that you asked about, like, but what if you knew that you could never go back? I think I just honestly haven't necessarily experienced that. Even when I talked about the tornado, like, in my head, I'm like, oh, I'd be okay. They're just things. But, I mean, there would definitely be some sadness and grief just about losing, like, that place that you've made home.
We're going to come back to this conversation. But first, I wanted to share some thoughts with you from someone else who has done really big moves, who recently moved from New York to Portland, who's in the midst of trying to create a sense of home in New York while also feeling homesick for Oregon. Frankly, for selfish and cathartic reasons, I wanted to talk to someone who could really relate to being in a long-term state of homesickness.
Hi.
Hey.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great.
Okay.
This is Vanessa.
Hi, I am Vanessa Pamela Friedman. I am a queer femme cis woman. I'm white and Jewish and fat, and I love the Pacific Northwest.
Vanessa is a writer, and she moved to New York City from Portland at the end of last summer, just before the new school year started, to start grad school. When I talked to Vanessa, she had just come back to New York from a trip to Portland over the holidays to visit friends and the place she loves.
How is it being back in New York?
It's okay. I was just in Portland for 2 weeks on my school break, and that was, like, amazing. So now I'm kind of like, oh, here again. But it's okay. I think I'm just, like, because I'm in school, I'm not viewing it as building a life. I'm just like, oh, I'm going back to school, and, like, this is my temporary life. It's okay. It's I mean, you know, it's not bad. I'm not like, wow, this is terrible. I chose to come here.
Yeah.
But it's not Portland. I feel like you and I are kindred spirits in that way, where I'm like, no one needs to be dramatic. This isn't terrible. Like, it's fine. It's even pleasant sometimes. Like, no, I'm not going to like lie and be like, New York is a nightmare. I'll, no, it's New York, you know, like it's great sometimes. And also my heart lives in Portland. I don't know what you want from me.
In fact, this isn't the first time she's lived in New York. Buckle up. Here's all the places she's lived.
So my parents are actually South African, and my dad was studying in the UK when I was born. So I was born in London, England, and then we moved back to South Africa. And then we moved to Toronto, Canada, when I was 4. And when I was 10, my dad got a job offer in Boston. And then I went to school in New York City.
For college, that is.
And then I spent a year living in Israel. And then when I came back, I lived in New York again. And then I got tired of living in New York. And I sort of traveled for a little while. And then I landed in Oregon. And I lived in Southern Oregon for a year. And I lived in Portland for 3 years. And now I am back in New York, but in the New York suburbs, not in New York City.
Probably a little less honking.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But still a surprising amount of honking, actually.
It's hard to talk about homesickness, though, without sharing the love story. The why behind why you're homesick. So let's back up. Because most love stories include some heartbreak. And we have to start with the last time that Vanessa lived in New York City.
Maybe because I'm a writer, but I think about world building in my stories. And then I think about life building in my reality. And we're all constantly kind of building lives. And it's just like, how content are you in your life? And like, obviously, it's a certain level of privilege to just have your basic needs met. And that's where you need to start. But then once, you know, you have a job that can pay you enough to like pay your rent and have groceries and feel like the level of like basic human needs being met, you know, then you can kind of start getting to feeding your soul. And so I always think like, is my soul being fed in any given place? And I think in New York City in my early 20s, it was. And then one day it wasn't.
I appreciate that you talk about that being a privilege, because that's one thing I know I have struggled with, is realizing that all my questions about what is home don't really have anything to do with my safety. You know, it's all these very like existential questions about home.
And yeah. And I don't think that's wrong at all. Your project resonates with me because I was like, oh yes, like I love thinking about those things too. But I also, honestly, it just feels irresponsible and like not a whole conversation to approach like my existential questions about home and feeding the soul without being like, okay, baseline, I am incredibly privileged. So like, that's why my brain is going to all these other spaces that people, lots of people resonate with.
So with that acknowledgement, we're going to dive deeper into this existential sea of home. In 2013, a few months after Vanessa left New York City, she wrote a piece entitled, "I Don't Know How to Say Goodbye, So I Wrote You This Instead," for Autostraddle, which is an independently owned online magazine and social network for lesbian, bisexual, and queer women, and non-binary people. In the piece, she writes, "Everything was going according to some sort of vague plan I had about how to be a 20-something person, until one day I woke up and knew I was doing it all wrong. That is how I've described it to everyone who's asked. Everything was really great until one day it wasn't, lots of people ask. Where I come from, it's strange to leave New York when you have a job and a girlfriend and an apartment. I was supposed to feel lucky, and for a long time I did. It really was a sudden shift. I started to wake up feeling anxious. I'd fall asleep next to the glow of my computer, and in the morning I'd grab my phone to check Twitter before I got out of bed. I hated these habits, but I couldn't stop. Part of my job was being online all the time. My responsibilities at the magazine multiplied and changed, and going into the office every day started to feel like drowning. I stopped trying and felt angry at myself. I started getting ocular migraines. And when I went to the eye doctor, he assured me that lots of people end up needing glasses because of the strain of staring at a screen all day. I wondered why I had to stare at a screen all day. The muscles in my right forearm started hurting all the time, and a girl in my writing workshop warned me not to type in bed because she had and now needed to sleep with a wrist brace for her carpal tunnel. I tried to picture what would make me feel happier. More money? A new job? More recognition? But none of it sounded good.
What if Gawker hired you? What would success look like? What would it feel like?
None of the supposed answers to success seemed appealing. I worried that digital media was not the place for me. I wondered what other people my age did in other parts of the country, other parts of the world. I tried to figure out what I actually wanted. I missed things I'd never had.
At first, the doubts and questions were small and quiet, so I just pretended they didn't exist. It is a poetic scientific fact that it is easier to stay than to go. Inertia.
But then one night at the beginning of May, I went to see Cheryl Strayed, one of my favorite authors, read at public assembly. I stood in the back by myself and wept as she read from the title essay in Tiny Beautiful Things, a book made up of advice columns she had written as Dear Sugar for the Rumpus. It is a letter to her 20-something self, filled with bits of wisdom and advice and reassurance. Less than a minute in, she read, "You don't need a reason to leave. Wanting to leave is enough. Be brave enough to break your own heart." I didn't stop crying while I waited in line to have her sign my book, and I cheerfully apologized when I finally stood in front of her, clutching my copy and a tissue. "Don't be sorry," she said. "Crying is the most human thing." "I know, but you're not supposed to cry in New York," I hiccuped. "That's okay," she said. "I'm not from New York." I nodded and willed myself to stop crying long enough to speak. "I'm not either," I said, "and be brave. I think I have to leave, and it kind of sucks." She looked up at me with such kindness as I twisted my mouth into a knot and tried unsuccessfully to blink away all my tears. "You know, it won't suck forever. That's one thing I can promise you. I promise it won't suck forever." I nodded, and she took my hand and said, "Close your eyes and let yourself see the beauty that's to come." She squeezed my hand and let go and signed my book, and I thanked her and left the venue, still crying. I started sobbing in earnest when I got outside and started walking north towards the East River. I walked all the way to the pier and sat on a bench overlooking the Manhattan skyline. And only then did I allow myself to open the book to the page she had signed. "To Vanessa," she wrote, "wishing you beauty on the journey." I took out my journal and wrote in all capital letters, "Where do I go from here?" But I put a period at the end of the sentence, not a question mark, because I already knew.
Yeah, Cheryl Strayed, patron saint of like all those of us who move.
Cheryl Strayed always comes up in my life somehow.
Yep, mine too. When I left New York in 2013, I did not feel homesickness for the city or that life at all. I felt so much excitement and so much sort of certainty that you can only feel in your early 20s that you look back and you're like, oh, wow, that kid didn't know anything.
In the same piece that I read an excerpt from earlier, Vanessa also writes this. "I spent the past 3.5 months plotting to go properly. When I left New York, I moved back in with my parents in a suburb close to Boston to clear my head and work as a part-time nanny and save money and figure out what I mean when I say I want an adventure. I've spent a lot of time questioning if I really am being brave. I'm scared. What if I'm not being brave or interesting or smart? What if I'm lying? What if I am boring and lazy and a bad writer? What if this is all a mistake? Now it's December, and I don't feel like I've figured anything out. But I promised myself I'd be gone by January 1st, 2014, and I'm going. I have a plane ticket to Israel booked for December 30th, and after that, everything is a question mark. It's unlike me not to have a plan. The only thing as consistent as my tendency to leave is my absolute obsession with orchestrating what comes next. But I've decided that 2014 is both my year of not knowing and being okay with not knowing. I'm going to see what opportunities come my way. I'm going to say yes. I'm going to find beauty on the journey. To read the entirety of this piece, check out the show notes or the episode landing page for a link.
I think a lot about the way the internet makes home kind of not always a physical space. Like sometimes it can just be the ether, you know? And I realized when I was first traveling, when I left New York, you asked if I was homesick, and I wasn't. But it's interesting because I remember very specifically now writing in my journal and writing my friends' emails and saying, I am not homesick for New York, but I am homesick for like the internet. Like I'm homesick for like the box of GChat.
Vanessa is talking about the chat box where she'd chat with her friends and the people she collaborated with and had grown close to at Autostraddle. Which, by the way, shouldn't be confused with the job she quit when leaving New York City.
And we had kind of created this space that was home online that I was no longer participating in when I was traveling, because part of what I was trying to do was like not be so addicted to my phone, to technology, to Wi-Fi, like to be more present in the places I was in. It really brought to focus to me that home had become this kind of like digital space where it was almost like a chat room that everybody I loved was in that we'd built for ourselves. And that was what I was missing.
So Vanessa traveled without a complete plan, but by the summer she ended up in Oregon.
I got to Oregon somewhat by accident, somewhat by fate.
Before traveling, Vanessa had been the community editor at Autostraddle. During this period, a reader had told Vanessa about a land project in southern Oregon and about woofing on the land. WOOF is an acronym for Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. Though the opportunities vary immensely and the types of farms that are included are equally as varied, woofing is when someone goes to one of these farms as a volunteer. Your room and board is covered, but you don't usually make any money unless you do extra work in your own time. So it's not an opportunity that everyone can afford. But it can be an inexpensive way to travel and to see other ways of how one could live. An opportunity that Vanessa felt incredibly lucky to be able to consider. Here's Vanessa talking about the reader Jillian, the person that first told her about the land project in southern Oregon.
And she was describing woofing at the land project. And she had so much more experience than I did at that time. I think I'd like been to like a petting zoo. And that was kind of my efforts of existing on a farm at that point. But it did really stick to me in that way. And when Jillian talked about it, I was like, wow, I want to go do that. I want to go meet these lesbians who own 46 acres of land. I want to try to do something different than just like sit at my computer. There are so many ways to live, right? I want to go like see what else is out there. And that was really the seed of how I found Oregon. I reached out to the women who own that land, Barb and Susie, and I asked if I could woof for them that summer. And they said, yeah, you know, it was like 9 months in advance. I think usually people reach out like a few weeks in advance. So I think they were kind of like, yeah, you're really overly enthusiastic. Like, get back in touch with us in a little. And I like, also had never lived on the West Coast, so I didn't really have a conception of the way East Coasters are versus West Coasters. And so I was very much like, well, no, like, let's like make a date and like, let's like figure it out. And like, we can like pencil it in. And in my head, I was like, wow, like, you know, we haven't set a date for like 9 months from now. How can I know this is really going to happen? And she was probably like,
who is this person wanting to, like, you know, plan out coming to live in a tent on our land?
So 9 months passed, the details were figured out, and around summertime, Vanessa headed to Oregon for the first time.
How can you go to Oregon and not fall in love? You know, like, you get there, and I first saw Oregon out a train window, and I was just sitting in the train, like, with my mouth open. And honestly, it's not even the most beautiful parts of Oregon that you're seeing when you come in on the train line, but I think the way some people describe, like, you know, you meet the right person at the right time. I think that's where I was at in terms of a place. I was just, like, in the exact right headspace to fall very deeply in love with the right place. And then Oregon showed up, and I was like, okay, cool, hi, here we are.
And then, as it always does, summer came to a close.
So I had planned to only spend the summer in Southern Oregon. It was definitely seasonal. I was living in a tent. I was helping out with tasks that are extremely seasonal. And by September, it was kind of like, oh, okay, like, what will I do next? But I loved it. I loved it so much, and I didn't want to leave. In my head, I'd had, like, an idea that I would be nomadic that year, but something I've come up against time and time again as I've explored traveling different places and meeting new people is that I love to nest and I love to really get to know a place. So I kind of have these, like, two competing sides of me. So I think that's always been kind of the push and pull for me. But in that particular instance, it just was obvious. Like, I couldn't leave. There felt like there was no reason for me to. I was so happy in that part of the country with those people learning new things, like, I was growing. And so I asked Barb if there was a way that I could stay on in the winter and do something.
They did find a way for Vanessa to stay on for the winter. She also went to Mexico for Barb and Susie's wedding and ended up staying in Mexico and woofing down there for a short time.
And my plan had been to come back to Southern Oregon. I mean, for a while, my plan was to live there forever. I was like, great, I found it. Like, this feels like home. This is where I want to be. Absolutely. But that year that I'd spent in Southern Oregon, I met a girl in Portland, and I fell in love with her, and she fell in love with me. And, you know, I used to joke when we were together, and it was a joke. I was like, she doesn't want to come live in, like, a renovated school bus in the middle of the woods with me. Like, I can't figure out why. But of course, ultimately, her life was in Portland, and we kind of agreed together that if we were going to give our relationship a real shot, it made sense to live in the same city. And I had visited Portland a few times by then, and I liked it. I also knew in my head and in my heart that if for some reason things didn't work out with us, it felt like there was enough for me in Portland that Portland might be a nice place to be.
And so Vanessa moved to Portland.
When I first visited Portland, it was the summer, and people used to tease me, and they said, be careful if you visit Portland in July, you'll never leave. Portland in the summer is perfect. It's the river, and it's going to the water when it's too hot, and it's all of the seeds that you planted in the spring exploding into a huge harvest bounty, and it's the roses all in bloom, and it's all these kids hanging out, and it's, you know, berries on every corner that you can just kind of, like, eat. It was like nothing I'd ever experienced, and it's so hard for me to describe Portland without just being like, it's home. I know it's not for everybody, but to me, I think I fell in love with Portland quickly. Partially because I think I was already in love with Oregon. If someone asked me to describe Portland now, I think it would be, it's impossible for me to describe Portland without thinking about all the people and the community that I have there. And I've really been interrogating myself and my own mind about what I mean when I talk about Portland, because objectively, I know the city has flaws, and I know that as
a white cis person in Portland, I am experiencing a very specific lived experience there that other folks are not experiencing.
Vanessa also mentioned that she has had a different experience of Portland because she didn't grow up there and she hasn't seen the city gentrify the way some people have.
So I do know that Portland is idealized for me in my brain, but I also can only speak from my lived experience. And I was so lucky to fall into a very strong, sparkly, robust, magical friend community in Portland. That to me now, when I close my eyes and I think about Portland, I just see so many people that I love. I see like my friends in sequined leotards, and I see all of us skinny dipping at the lake, and I see us getting in a car and going on hikes.
And so it wasn't that Vanessa wanted to leave Portland. She loved the life she'd built in the Pacific Northwest. But she did really want to go to grad school.
In truth, I don't think I knew it was time to leave Portland. I think it was time for a change, but I don't think I knowingly made that so. Maybe in my very, very, very deep subconscious, I was like, okay, it's time to make some changes, but I'm not convinced I would have made a lot of those changes had I not gotten into grad school outside of Portland. Honestly, in my heart of hearts, as I'm thinking about this and telling you about this, I'm like, was it time to leave Portland? Like, do I wish I was still there? And like, yes, a part of me totally wishes I was still there. But I really, really, really wanted to go to grad school, and I wanted to push myself in this like next step in my life and my career.
I know that when I left LA, you know, because I did not want to move to New York, but I decided I wanted to see where my relationship could go, you know, because my partner got a job out in New York. And I remember just feeling devastated about leaving the West Coast, but also felt like, because I had gotten complacent and comfortable and self-sabotagey about some things, like career-wise in LA. And it just felt like this giant catalyst and opportunity, even if it was like an incredible growing pain at the same time.
Absolutely.
So with both growing pains and opportunity on the table, Vanessa moved east, but not before she threw a big going away party. She spent the summer trying to see the people that she loved as much as she could, but also allowed herself to relax and be present. She decided to plant a garden, even though she wouldn't see those flowers bloom before she left. It was around the time that she threw her going away party, while I was in the midst of my first sweaty New York City summer, that I noticed on Instagram stories Vanessa was moving and that she was also incredibly sad to be leaving Portland. We'd found and followed each other for a while on Instagram because we both love hiking and have spent a lot of time on the Pacific Crest Trail. But because of the Instagram algorithm, I'd missed a good chunk of what was going on in Vanessa's life. So I messaged her and said, "Where are you moving?" I cried my eyes out leaving LA earlier this year. So bittersweet to experience the excitement of a new home and deep homesickness at the same time. Much love to you in this transition time. She responded, "Oh my gosh, yes, exactly. I'm moving to the East Coast, to New York for school. I feel so excited about the future and also so, so, so sad about leaving Portland." I felt for Vanessa, and I also felt less alone. To hear someone else express excitement and grief in the same moment was powerful.
Once you had left Portland and you got to New York, what did that feel like?
Honestly, getting to New York felt bad at first. I
I appreciate the project you're doing so much, because I think in some ways I feel a little silly talking about it. And I know it's feelings that like everybody feels. And like you said, you know, everyone has home feelings and stories, but to kind of put words to being like, oh, I got to this new place and like, I felt like mad that my friends weren't here, and I felt sad and lonely. And I'm like, Vanessa, really? But yeah, really, like when I first moved to New York, I just felt lonely, you know? I felt like really out of place and really uncertain that I'd made the right choice, and just bummed out.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm wiping away tears right now.
Yeah.
I know I felt like when I got to New York that I was grieving. And I mean, I feel like in New York is, there's so many people that want to come to that area that I also felt like, you're being ungrateful for this opportunity. But I was like, still grieving.
No, that's so real. And then you're like not even being kind and gentle to yourself, because you're like, come on, buck up. And it's like, no, like it's okay that you don't feel great about leaving a place that you loved for a brand new place that you have no connection to yet. I think homesickness struck me in some ways that I expected and some ways that I didn't expect. I've never lived alone before, and I live alone right now in New York. So that's a big shift, and definitely highlighted the loneliness very clearly, very much right away. So I asked my mom to come help me move. My parents live outside of Boston, and that helped the transition. I'm close with my mom. It was meaningful that I got here, and she was like, okay, Vanessa, make the bed, like stop looking so bereft, like just make the bed. What are some things we can put on the walls that'll make you feel a little happier?
Vanessa admits that she has a very outgoing personality, and also that going to school has a built-in way for her to make friends. Though I don't have either of those things, what both of us do have in common is that we both really miss the friendships that we'd built over time. It's possible to make new friends quickly and have meaningful conversations, but it simply takes time to build those really close, deep friendships. It's one of the hardest parts of moving. Making friends as an adult is hard. I tell Vanessa how important the phone has become to me and how much I look forward to having long-distance phone dates with my friends.
I always joke that I am in multiple long-distance relationships now with all my best friends. I also do think so much of my connection to Oregon and to Portland is the outdoor activity that I did while I was there.
Before moving to Oregon, Vanessa had never seen herself as outdoorsy. But there, she found places and a community that empowered her to get outside.
I definitely discovered my love of doing outdoor things in Oregon. Like, Oregon is where I felt empowered to start hiking and where I really, like, came into my own and being, like, adventurous in that way and, like, realizing that I don't hate swimming. I hate, like, chlorinated swimming pools and the locker room where I always felt really, like, shy and embarrassed with my body. But skinny dipping in a lake with, like, a bunch of, like, fat, body-positive queer people feels amazing to me. I do like swimming. I just don't like feeling ashamed of my body. You know, it's weird, like, the things that we associate together. And so much of what made Oregon feel like home to me was exploring outside and, like, learning to feel comfortable in my body.
When we're lonely and far away from the places we love, it can make those places seem so wonderful, extra wonderful.
Especially because I'm not in Portland right now. I've fully romanticized everything in my head. Like, I miss the rain right now. I don't miss the rain. That's not true. But, like, in my heart right now, I miss the gray rain of Portland winter. I was talking to my ex recently, and she was kind of feeling, like, eye-rolly with Portland, and the things she was saying were valid and were things that, like, I found frustrating just a few months ago when I lived there. But
I was just laughing at myself because I was like, nothing you say can get me down right now. Like, I just love it. I just miss it. And it's because I'm not there. It's because I'm like missing a thing that I love. And I can see that, but it also doesn't make the feeling any less true. So I don't know. I kind of tease myself often. I say, I moved to New York right now to be in school to write a million love letters to Portland. Like, how silly is that?
And Vanessa has been writing love letters to Portland. When I'd first asked Vanessa if she wanted to chat about home and homesickness, I wasn't yet subscribed to her newsletter. Shortly after we talked, I did subscribe, and then I found out that her newsletter, which is called I Miss You, is basically a set of love letters to Portland. And right now, she's doing a home series within the newsletter. These home letters touch on so many of her different homes, tangible and intangible.
We use the word home to mean so many different things that don't mean the same thing at all. Like, this is my home in New York. When I'm at school, I tell people, oh, I'm going to go home now. But to call this space home, which I'm trying to cultivate into a home that I live in, versus like to call Portland home, versus to call like how earlier I was telling you how like Autostraddle online had been this, you know, not concrete, but very meaningful home. Home kind of like, we can't do justice to the word because those, even just those three examples, are so different from each other.
Here's an excerpt from her home letter number 7. I guess the thing I'm thinking about this week is how community and friendship function in making a place feel like home, simply on a practical level. If I had not made the connections I did in Portland, would I have fallen in love so hard? How much of my love for this place could be mapped onto another city with the right combination of an open mind and friends with common interests, like glitter and talking for hours on the sofa in their living room and cooking and making mundane events into special occasions in a karaoke bar or two. Do my friends make Portland home? Are they the icing on the cake, or are they every single ingredient? Would this city have become home without my friend family? Now that it is home, would I uproot my heart if the people I love here left? I know the short answer to all of the above questions. Of course my friends make this city my whole world, but I suspect there are longer answers too. Answers that include the fact that a handful of humans I love live in Boston, but that city never managed to feel like home. Or the fact that part of what I love in Portland is my solitude in the woods, or my garden, or Townshend's basement, when it's literally just me, alone. And then there are the distance goggles. Everyone is hotter when you miss them. It's the law of long-distance relationships. I'm not so naive. I've got links to Vanessa's email newsletter sign-up and to the archive in the show notes and the episode landing page. Right now, Vanessa's on the cusp of summer break and ready to go back to the Pacific Northwest for the summer. In the meantime, she's trying to cultivate a sense of home by cooking, having new friends over, and trying to find a grocery store that she likes. Because newsflash, Portland has some really great co-ops and grocery stores that are hard to give up. You know, when I was feeling my loneliest and most homesick when I first got to New York, I felt like no one would understand why I was so sad. It's why it was so nice to talk to Vanessa, even if it was many months after I'd moved to New York. I was too afraid to tell the New York friends I was making just how sad I was, because I didn't want them to think I was poo-pooing New York City. But I had forgotten that one of the most human things is to try and connect the dots, even if your experiences are not the same. This takes us back to my recent conversation with my sister, Shelley. She wasn't homesick. She was thriving in her home. But the more we talked, and the more I described my feelings, the more she dug.
And I'm kind of thinking these, like, as I'm talking, these things are coming. It's not like things I've had this idea for forever. But the more I'm thinking about it, I think, like, home needs to be, like, where you are. Meaning, like, you need to be present and, like, thriving in the place that you're at. And therefore, you make that place your home, regardless of how long you're going to be there.
And that totally makes sense. I think I'm
been asking a lot of questions because I believe that I can find contentment in good things about any place or almost any place. But then how much effort do I put into, like, I will live anywhere? And then is there a point where I'm like, I must go back? And that's just something I've been asking. But.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, I haven't had to do that. Like, I haven't moved super far away. And so I've always, I end up coming back to Dallas. Well, actually, now I think about it. So when I was applying for jobs right out of college, like originally I was like, I do not want to go back home because I know if I go back home, I'm going to stay there. I'm going to get stuck there. I'm never going to go anywhere else. So I applied other places, applied out of state, well, you know, everywhere. And then I did apply to jobs in Dallas, though, because it's, you know, like a rational thing to do. You want to apply everywhere to keep all your options open. And I remember getting denied for the last job in Dallas. Like I had gone through all the interviews and I got denied. And all of a sudden, just like this wave of emotion came over me and I had to go to the bathroom and I just started bawling. And oh my gosh, it's like making me emotional thinking about it. But I just started bawling in the bathroom stall thinking, like, I'm not going back. And it was devastating. I don't even know honestly why, but in that moment I realized I really, really did want to come back to Dallas. Like, I didn't need to live with mom and dad, I didn't need that, but... And I never realized that until that moment. Then I got a call later saying that, hey, they would like to open up a job just for me at this hospital on this floor that I absolutely wanted. So it was like a complete, like, providential thing that I ended up back in Dallas. And it was just like that last chance to be back. And when I got offered that job, like, I just knew, like, oh, absolutely. Because I had... like had that appalling realization in a bathroom stall that, like, oh, I do want to be back in Dallas. I can't even tell you why. And because of that, because I can't tell you why, like, the only reason in my mind is that I was, like, meant to be back here. And I mean, that's where I met Casey. I have a job that I love, like, community that I love. And not to say that I can't move now. Like, yes, it would be very, very hard, but it just took a nice wave of emotion to slap me in the face to make me realize that. So it wasn't necessarily like a homesickness, because I feel like homesickness is usually the initial feeling that you have when you first leave. But maybe, I don't know. It just was on the back end rather than on the front end. Dang it, Julie. You would... Oh, you got me. Unfortunately, it's always the crying parts that end up in your podcasts.
Yeah. Because dramatic effect, hello. My goal is to make people cry as often as possible.
I guess it was just all of a sudden it was like reliving that moment.
Yeah.
You know, doing that. But
well, that's like, I mean, I've been so interested in the whole concept of home because it's tied to so many parts of everyone's life and really emotional parts.
Yeah.
What I really was trying to do, since you've been having these allergies, is help you clear out your eyeballs with the saline solution of your own tears.
And you know it's helping. It's helping a little bit, so I appreciate that. Oh, girl.
Thanks to my sister, Shelley, for letting me ask her a bunch of questions and for letting me share her tears. And thanks to Vanessa Pamela Friedman for talking to me about homesickness and home. We talked for a really long time, and there's so much more I wish I could have included. You can find Vanessa on Twitter, at Vanessa Pamela, and on Instagram, at Vanessa Takes Photos. I've also got links to all of this in the show notes in the episode landing page, along with links to her newsletter and website. Also, because I love the outdoors, and because Vanessa talked about autostraddle, I've got a link to the current online issue, which is themed Outsiders, which is sponsored by REI. Vanessa is one of the editors for this issue and has a few articles appearing in it as well. This podcast is currently an independent, unfunded project. If you like this podcast, help spread the word, tell a friend, rate and review it. It supposedly really helps, and it would be greatly appreciated. This episode was hosted and produced by Julie Hotz, and all music was composed by myself as well. Thanks for listening.